This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
So there are reports that humanitarian aid members of, and members of the media are being denied entry into Rakhine. So why is this so? And has the Myanmar government actually given any reason for this move?
Well, we're not talking about just reactionary humanitarian aid here. There's also pre-planned humanitarian aid, which has become routine since 2012. The World Food Programme normally feeds about 80,000 to 85,000 people in the area. These aid deliveries have been disrupted and the military has prevented any supplies from getting through. This is because of the manner in which the military conducts security affairs. They isolate villages, they find suspects, they weaken resolves. And the government and Aung San Suu Kyi has not and does not probably cannot challenge the military on security issues, which is why if you ask the Myanmar government, you will hear excuses. So for instance, Meng Kiao, a government spokesman, said that the government was unable to contact anyone in the area because it was a military-operated red zone. They will say that they were not able to confirm that information. And this is the case in the 2012 violence as well. You can have ministers and government officials there, but they won't be able to stop any violence that is going on.
Hazik, this is Sharad speaking. You talk about 2012, those attacks. It led to a huge number of people being seeking safety in camps for the internally displaced. What is the magnitude of that problem? Are we talking about hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of people?
Are you talking about the 2012 incident? Okay.
Yeah, and the subsequent, you know, fact that people are in camps for the internally displaced.
Well, for the camps, they are definitely numbering in the thousands. And we shouldn't just look at the camps because the rest of the population, which are not living in camps, their movements are restricted, heavily restricted as well. So it's as if they are living in a camp itself. And if you look at the current situation, because the military is trying to force out some of these individuals that they think are the ones responsible for the attacks. There are hundreds of villagers who are now living in rice fields without any food supply and any shelter over their head.
Hazik, Jason here again. So the Myanmar government also has blamed the attacks on local Rohingya insurgents under the Rohingya Solidarity Organization. So what do we know about this organization? And is there actually a history of violence and insurgency among the Rohingya population in Rakhine State?
If you talk about insurgency, probably not. RSO, they existed in the 1980s and they had links to Bangladesh, Pakistan and Afghanistan and even possibly in the Middle East. But they have gotten dormant at least since 2001. What I can say is that they have probably been revived by the jihadist economy in South Asia where groups are competing with each other. If you need to know, ISIS-aligned groups and Al-Qaeda-aligned groups are competing for more recruits and more relevance in the region, and they want to show the world that they are the only ones who care about the Rohingyas.
Yes, and this, of course, follows reports that Rohingya are being recruited and trained in insurgency tactics in Bangladesh and Pakistan. This was claimed by Indian intelligence as well as Myanmar's own intelligence agency, right? So is this further evidence that foreign terrorist organizations, possibly from neighboring Bangladesh, inciting some sort of insurgency among the Rohingya?
Yes, and the thing is, we're not even sure whether or not the Rohingyas they are talking about actually live in the Arakan state. They could have been people who have migrated over to Bangladesh since the historical refugee diaspora, maybe since 1980s and even earlier. So these people could even be second generation Arakanese who have migrated out. And because they are not living in the consequences of their actions, they are not living in Arakan at the moment, they do not know that actually inciting violence is only going to cause even more damage to the local population. So yes, these groups are inciting and hijacking the cause of the humanitarian cause of self-identification. They're trying to get aid, they're trying to get food and so on. At the same time, we cannot say that the local Arakanese are the ones who are responsible because they have no food, they are hungry, they cannot afford, they don't have weapons, they cannot do anything. And their movements are severely restricted as well.
So if this is indeed a militant attack, what kind of policy implications will this have on the security of the region?
Well, firstly, if this is a militant attack, it means South Asian groups have a foothold. The South Asian jihadists have punched the imaginary border into Southeast Asian jihadism. you know, as ISIS weakens in the Middle East and Al-Qaeda takes a quietist tone, the Southeast Asians will turn to these jihadist groups for help. We have the Philippines as an undeclared wilaya of ISIS, and we have hundreds, if not at least 1,000 potential returnees from the Syrian and Iraqi conflict, and they will look to Pakistan, Afghanistan, Bangladesh for help, just like the JI in the Nusantara was given training in the Afpak region. So regional security forces cannot just look at the Indonesian archipelago or the southern Philippines if they are attempting to address the security issues in the region. They should be also on the lookout for militant-related activities which are anchored around the narrative of the Rohingyas. And all parties cannot afford the political dispute between the Rohingya and the Myanmar state to be hijacked by this global jihadism, because then it complicates matters further. As it is now, people cannot differentiate, at least the government cannot differentiate between what is a humanitarian issue and what is a security issue and where the line is supposed to be drawn. The way the military is going on with things, they are not being very strategic in actually securing the support of the local population, which we all suspect are definitely not responsible for the attacks.
Hazik, Sharad again. The question of the narrative that's being constructed, hasn't it always served the purposes of the military when they were in government, now, so as it were, supporting government, to cast this as, as coming from Muslims who are not loyal to the state and not wanting to acknowledge the high level of Buddhist chauvinism that's in fact resulted in much of the violence, the displacement, the alienation that Muslims in the Arakan or Rakhine state suffer?
Yes, definitely. It's been an excuse that's been going on. If you need, like, basically in Yangon, in major areas in Myanmar, people think that the Arakanis, and not just the Muslims, they consider them as pariahs. There's even a saying that if you find a snake and an Arakanis on the road, you kill the Arakanis first. This kind of chauvinism has not been basically acknowledged by the rest of Myanmar. And if you look at the way in which the military and the government secure peace deal with ethnic groups, they only secure peace deal with particular ethnic groups, not those that are not recognized, and especially not the Rohingyas.
What about the larger problem of Buddhist chauvinism and the state in Myanmar? We had, those attacks at Maitila a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, with, businesses and homes of Muslims who are not Rohingya being attacked, people killed. Do you think with Aung San Suu Kyi now heading the government, there is the kind of political will to resolve, heal wounds, create bridges, and push Myanmar towards some sort of reconciliation process?
Okay, first of all, we must understand that in Myanmar, some paradigms have yet to change. The first paradigm that is core in Myanmar belief is actually the ethnic paradigm, and they still haven't gotten over that in order for them to behave like the ideal democratic state that they should be behaving, especially when there's so much tension going on. So there is always tension, and like you said, it's not just against the Rohingyas. The military has persecuted so many groups in Myanmar, and only some ethnic groups are allowed for negotiation for peace deals, while others are still considered pariahs. And if you talk about Arakanis as a whole, they are not respected whether or not they are Muslims or Buddhists. And the tension that exists between them is as if they are a group of hungry people fighting for survival. And there tends to be tensions between groups that we think is between Buddhists and Muslims, but it could be a question of survival and hunger, actually.
Hazik, Jason here. One final question. So how has this situation been affecting Myanmar's move towards democracy?
Well, definitely lack of rule of law is the first factor in this violence, and the government still has no power over the military, especially in their conduct. So, as I said before, ministers can witness violence, but they cannot do anything about it, and I don't know what is democracy without rule of law. I don't know what to call it. It's not even a step back or a hindrance. It's a step that has yet to be taken, but we have to give them time. And maybe what these attacks have told us and showed us is maybe Myanmar does not have the time to still lag behind in rule of law. The government need to be able to tell the military that it's not strategic to go against the Rohingya population and they are frontier population with a bordering Bangladesh, and they are actually important to Myanmar, strategically speaking.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.